Good morning, and welcome to the Nancy Cantor Warehouse. My name is Emily Winicky, and I am the Community Engagement Coordinator here at Syracuse University. I would like to begin, as we do with all Syracuse University events, by acknowledging with respect the Onondaga Nation, the Indigenous people on whose ancestral lands Syracuse University now stands. As many of you may know, this is our first collaborative TMR with Focus Greater Syracuse. In a town the size of Syracuse, we felt that instead of compete with one another, we should work together and have more joint programs since we have similar missions. So I would like to welcome our friends from Focus, and I hope you will join us again at TMR in the future. I'm now going to turn it over to Jim Keep, the Executive Director of Focus Greater Syracuse, to introduce our speakers.
Thank you, Emily. Yeah, I was going to say, a lot of you came to a TMR and a Focus forum broke out. So we're very, very happy that this is happening. It was a discussion that I had with B. Gonzalez a few months ago, and we talked about, isn't there a way that maybe we can do some joint things? A lot of other people have mentioned that to us, so we decided let's get that going, and we were very happy when we approached them about this series on economic development and said that we really wanted to conduct it on a Thursday, that they were open and let us arrange to do this. I also want to thank the Onondaga Civic Development Corp for sponsoring this series of sessions. At the end, I'll give you a little more information on what's upcoming. I want to make sure that we stick to the hour time frame, though, so we're going to change a little bit of the order of the way things are usually done with Focus forums, and we'll do at the end if there's any announcements that people want to share. We'll do it then so we make sure that we keep within the 60 minutes. Some of you may say to yourself, well, why is Focus involved in something that has to do with economic development? Well, as a reminder, the mission statement for Focus is we're a citizen-driven organization that taps citizen creativity to bring about change in central New York by enabling citizens, organizations, and government to work together to enhance the quality of our lives and our economic future. So we are about community engagement, and citizens are engaged when they play a meaningful role in deliberations and discussions and decision-making. You can read the rest of that, but community engagement has a direct connection to community development. What is community development? Community development can be understood as a planned effort to build assets that increase the capacity of residents to improve the quality of life. These assets may include several forms of community capital: physical, human, social, financial, environmental, political, and cultural. You'll see some of that mentioned, I believe, in some of the slides. Jim DeMesis, one of our speakers, is also very much connected, as is Chris, to the community development side and how that community development supports economic development. The benefits of community development, such as employment and infrastructure, come through local people changing attitudes, mobilizing existing skills, improving networks, thinking differently about problems, and using community assets in new ways. So that's how community development really supports economic development, and I guess long-winded, that's how Focus gets themselves from what our mission is into tying into the subject of economic development. In today's competitive marketplace, it's critical to have an engaged, informed, and educated community that is supportive of economic development efforts being taken on their behalf. It is incumbent upon communities to remain attractive places that can stimulate new economic opportunities through all sorts of economic cycles. Communities that are intentional in supporting their business communities have better economic and social results than those that don't, and I think you'll see that come across in both of the presentations that Jim and Chris are going to give today. Real quickly, I won't read the bios of Chris and Jim. You have those in front of you. But I do want to say about Jim. Jim DeMesis has more than 25 years of experience in public policy research and analysis that leads to good decision making. He brings a holistic, innovative approach to market analysis and planning work. Through his work with the communities of the future, he is a national leader in preparing the profession, communities, and regions for an emerging economic future. And just a few quick words on Chris, who will follow Jim. Chris has over 25 years of business, economic development, and location strategy experience. His background in small city planning and a big four consulting firm and a world-class engineering and supply chain company allow him to provide the clients with an unusually broad perspective on how place affects business success. So he too is very much in tune on what happens within the community and how the community can have a direct impact on their future and economic development. So let us get us started. I'll bring up Jim DeMesis.
Great. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good group. So just real quickly, a little bit of background, just so you know who's talking with you. So I'm Jim DeMesis. I'm the Senior Vice President of Camoin Associates. Camoin is an economic development firm. We do all things economic development in terms of data analysis and strategy development. And we do that through market studies, impact studies, strategic planning for economic development, and providing overviews of local and regional economies. We're located out of Saratoga Springs, New York. We do a lot of work in the state of New York. But I myself am out of Portland, Maine. So I'm bringing somewhat of an outsider perspective, but I've also worked a bunch here in New York as well as my colleagues at Camoin. What I'm going to talk about is a little bit about what economic development is. So some of you who are in the economic development profession, you're going to be like, hey, I already know that, but I just want to get people on the same page in terms of what we think of when we talk economic development. And some of what we're talking about today is I'm going to be drawing it from both like research and sort of best practices in economic development, but I'm also going to be drawing it from the experience working with clients, and our clients include industry, businesses, but lots of public sector and nonprofit clients as well. So I'm going to be drawing that in as we go. So in terms of what economic development is, if I had a group of people and I asked everybody to define it, including if I was in a group of economic developers, I'd probably get somewhere around 80 to 100 answers. And that's okay, because the economy is a system, so people are going to describe economic development a bit differently in terms of what part of the system are they talking about. But I like to use a really simple example, which fits well for the kind of work that I do, so it makes it easier to understand. For me, economic development involves planning, organizing, and then acting to support the economy. I think about it in terms of, so what does that mean? What does that result in? So some common end goals, and there could be others, but common end goals are job stability and creation. Can we do the planning, organizing, and acting to sort of create jobs, sustain jobs, provide good wages? Depending on what level of government you're doing or geography that you're doing economic development, it also involves stabilizing the tax base. In a lot of communities, that means the property tax base and the real estate tax base. But it's about both stability and sustainability. Can we keep what we have and make it healthy, but can we also grow it to create new opportunities for people? It's also about diversification. So in other words, I work in a lot of communities where sometimes they have all their eggs in one or two baskets, like a defense community, a community that has like a giant corporate headquarters. I had mentioned that I live in Maine. We have a lot of communities that were paper mill communities where they have a really large tax base, but it's all in one industry or one business. So economic development is often about trying to diversify the tax base to spread the opportunities and spread the risk, if you will, around economic downturns. And then finally, it's also about wealth creation and diversification. So you can have areas that are doing really well for certain people or certain businesses, but then there's a lot of poverty or there's a lot of income disparity. And so common end goal, in fact, more and more a common end goal is around how are we going to not only grow the economy, but how are we going to make sure there's opportunities across all income levels. And again, that could be whether it's at the local level, the neighborhood level, the state or the national level, these same kind of common end goals and sort of process of what economic development is would apply. How does it get done? I'm not going to go into each of these, but in terms of the profession of economic development, there's a lot of different tools and techniques. And some of you work in this and you concentrate on one or more of these. For instance, Chris will be talking, and he deals a lot with global trade and foreign investment, but there's a lot of different tools in there that involve economic development. It's about, can I retain and expand the businesses that I have? Can I attract new businesses? Can I develop the talent, the workforce, and the skills to support businesses and workers? Can I bring in global trade and global connections? Technical assistance to help small businesses with their business planning and lending programs that help the businesses grow. And you have a lot of this in the Syracuse region, including through like Tech Garden, where there's innovation and entrepreneurship and technology, programs and services around economic development. And then there's a whole line of tools and techniques around place-based economic development, creating really quality, special places, pedestrian ways, parks, places that people could live, work, and play and either want to be at or visit. And then, as Jim said, it's also tied into not just workforce development, but also community development, making good, vibrant communities. And again, it's all done through planning, organizing, implementing, and developing the resources to sustain it all. But it's more than just that. At the end of the day, it's a system, and a system is more than just tools, techniques, goals, and outcomes. It's really about people. So it's all the people that are, whether it's starting a business, growing a business, looking for a job, being in a neighborhood and trying to make it vibrant, providing services to people to make their lives better, educating people at the university. It's really about people. And those people are organized through networks. This right here is what you have, is a network. It's people who come together, network, learn, share, but you do many different things. You have other hats that you wear. So, and then some of you are also in organizations, the university, the nonprofit, the business, so on and so forth. So when if you understand that economic development is really about people, it's not just buildings and infrastructure, the key pieces to that, the key functions, if you will, are interactions, relationships, communication, collaboration. And that's why this is a very unique type of forum, as well as the last night we addressed the Citizens Academy. And that's also something that I think is fairly unique. I know it might exist in some other places, but not a lot of places have that kind of learning, sharing, and engagement that was being done. And that's really at the heart of successful economic development. This is going to be hard to see and hard to, and it looks messy, and it's meant to be. Because what I want to point out is a lot of times in economic development books or, you know, in classes, if you will, in how to learn how to do economic development, they put it in really clean boxes that are linear and it all makes sense and it looks kind of easy. And then you just got to be an expert at each of those things and be efficient. But in reality, economic development is a system. It can be messy. It involves a lot of different pieces. And I'll just read out some of these for those of you who can't see it. But it includes everything from real estate development, corridors, downtowns, redevelopment if you're dealing with a city like Syracuse, new land and site development, infrastructure planning. But then it also includes quality of place, things that communities and neighborhoods do that are impacted by land use regulations, zoning, permitting, marketing, like tourism and things like that that make quality of place a key piece. But it's also about innovation, entrepreneurship. So it's having people that support new businesses, startups, working with the university to get spin-offs on their research and development. The thing about this that I want to point out is, and there's a lot that are still missing from here.
Like government.
Actually, it's on the chart, but it's good. I'm glad you said that because down the bottom it says elements a municipality can affect down towards land use and zoning. And what I'm trying to point out is no one entity has control over all of these things. So I could want to be doing workforce development as a workforce organization or economic development as an economic development organization, but I can't tell the university what to do. I can't tell all the education institutions exactly what they should be doing and make them do it. I got to collaborate with them. I got to pull them into the system and work with them. Same thing with a municipality. I could want to be talking about how I want to attract companies, but I can't impact the global economy. So I have no control as one entity over any of this. but I must learn how to and build capacity for doing well within this system by communicating, collaborating, sharing, and connecting, all part of networks. Now, we can try to make this look as clean and simple as we want, and we can say we're going to assign one organization to that. But in today's world, if someone wants to get something done, they can just create another organization, and they don't have to live by anyone's rules. So we have to work together around economic development. And a lot of times that means communities working with each other, which is something in the Northeast that we're not particularly good at. We like to work individually with our municipalities, but not collectively. But there are great examples here in this region around like Center State Economic Development and around working together not only across communities, but across counties as well. Things are changing in economic development, and I'm just going to highlight a few of these changes and then give a few details, and then I'm going to end with some lessons in the field, and then I'll turn it over to Chris. But the picture today is about rapid change. Things are changing rapidly, and it's disrupting industries, but it's also disrupting economic development. Automation, automation has made things so that we're concerned now about we're going to be able to grow companies without necessarily growing jobs. We've been able, I mentioned that I'm from Maine. We've lost a lot of jobs in the paper industry. But actual output and production is up. But it's just less people are needed to do the same jobs. And that's just one extreme example, but it can be applied across essentially any industry. We're now in a digital world, and that impacts every single industry that we work in, and it therefore impacts economic development. There is fierce competition. Communities compete with each other. Here in New York, we know that very well through some of the state programs that, for better or for worse, they put out programs that say, hey, we want you to compete for this money. So you are therefore competing for a large state grant or a program to therefore focus on a certain industry or an economic development initiative. And Chris will talk more about competition from the business and industry side about competing for industries coming here. But it's all being done more and more, and a real good comment was brought up last night around this. It's all being done under the requirement of transparency. It's not like transparency wasn't important in the past. It's just that today, when people have every bit of knowledge potentially at the tip of their hands with their phones and their computers, they expect to know a lot more about how things are made, how government runs, how decisions are made. So therefore, we have to have transparency in what we do, and that adds to the messiness. I'm not saying it's bad. I'm just saying it adds to making decisions much more complex. And then finally, it's around shifting business cultures. We can't just in business say, hey, I think we figured out the market. We're going to make widgets for the next 40 years. So let's figure out the most efficient way to make those widgets. And we're just going to continue to do that the same way now that we figured it out. Well, we don't even know if widgets are going to exist in 5 years. So think about it. If you started a business, I've been in business 20 years on the private sector side. And in that period of time, while there was the internet when I began, there was not so much information and data available. I used to make good money by just taking data that I got off of sheets and in town halls and libraries, putting it into spreadsheets and popping up a couple of pie charts. Today, I have to subscribe to data systems that allow me to automatically pull that in, and then they're also telling me what to think about that data. So we've had to adapt in terms of not only in terms of our business, but think about it in terms of like other businesses as well, like whether it's agriculture or manufacturing, it's all been impacted by this shifting business culture. So a few of those trends in more detail that I'm going to talk about, and again, I can put up 20 more of these, but I wanted to give you some focus and just hit on a few of them, and I'll walk through these. Workforce. Workforce is, again, I think in the old days we used to think about workforce systems over here, we used to think about community development over here, and business and economic development over here, but as I said in that earlier slide, it's all related, it's all part of the same thing. I've talked to thousands of companies in the past 20 years, CEOs, finance managers, plant directors. I've done it from small muscle farmers to large paper companies to aerospace contractors all over the country. And they talk about a lot of things, but they always talk about workforce. The number one issue is, can I get and retain the talent and skills that I need to make my company competitive? And so it's critical to economic development. Now, the problem with that is as things change and are adapting, it's becoming more and more difficult to train workers and retain them for the long time. Skills quickly become outdated. New methods, new innovation take over. In manufacturing, we've had to deal with 3D printing, which makes computers connected to manufacturing machines that can make goods and products on demand, as opposed to an assembly line sort of process. And now we're moving manufacturing over from not just automation, but to being connected to the internet. So everything, every bit of the machinery, every bit of the supply chain is all connected via the internet. And therefore, it's all about networks and connecting those things. And therefore, things like cybersecurity, network administration, which sound like they're all in the IT world, are actually critical to the manufacturing world. So the important thing on workforce is we have to have new processes and new ways of learning that, A, realize it's about lifelong learning. We're no longer going to be able to say, hey, I'm going to go to this school or I'm going to follow this career path, and that's going to be my career for 40 years. We're more likely going to be getting careers and jobs and changing those over every 3, 5, 10 years and needing to reskill and retrain throughout our entire life. Not just because our one industry went down in our community or one industry changed, but because all industries have changed. I already talked about the tech and the rapid change, but I just want to say that at first we would hear things like, hey, health tech is coming. And we'd hear it like, oh, healthcare and technology, I get it. IT and learning about how using computer simulations and telehealth and things like that. But now the word tech, add it on to any industry sector, and we've got a new dynamic, new platforms for industry. Things like health tech, FinTech, which is the finance and insurance business, using algorithms to help with financing. Industry 4.0, manufacturing tech, which is the connected Internet of Things, all impacting the supply chain. So the digital technologies, IT, and the Internet have changed every single industry that we have, creating a demand for new business models. It's all about ecosystems. In fact, there are people now in economic and community development who have titles such as ecosystem builder or ecosystem supporter. You would never hear that a few years ago. So people are recognizing that economic development is complex and that it's all part of a system, and therefore understanding and thinking about it from a systems approach and networking are all part of making healthy economies. Again, you would never think about that 5 or 6 years ago, 10 years ago, about having an ecosystem builder person in your organization. The key in those systems of ecosystem is that in today's world, while capital is important, dollars are important to build companies and help support industries and do economic development, when you're dealing in the network world and you're dealing with ecosystems, trust is the currency. For my two communities to work together, for my company to work with an industry or the Syracuse University, there has to be a high level of trust. Because I can't get everything done myself, we all need each other, but I need to trust that we can get it done. Place is very important. Now there's also, we hear about placemaking and economic development. And these are like downtown corporations and neighborhood organizations, whether they're building pocket parks, greater pedestrian ways, integrating art and design into the community. Again, this used to be the world of planning, if you will, planners, land use planners, and designers and engineers. It's now been more integrated with economic development. And the reason it's so important is it's not just that it creates great areas to look at and be at for our communities, but again, it relates to workforce development. Workforce wants to live and work, or at least work, in places that have a good, that are quality. They have access to amenities, they can get out and walk on trails and things like that. So it's become more and more important. There's a bunch of, I already mentioned trust, but what's it take to succeed in economic development? And then I'll close on one last slide after this one about some tips. But I mentioned that trust is important in building that trust. A new kind of leadership. So we can't just do command and control anymore. We have to understand data and information. We have to network. We have to understand the strengths of our partners and our ecosystem. And that requires a new kind of leadership. We can no longer, as leaders, be experts in every aspect of what we do. We've got to trust other people. We've got to communicate. We have to have new funding models. Here, but also where I live in Maine, we are purely based on the property tax as a way to fund local government. And that no longer is working in the new economy. It's just not providing the right kind of resources to update infrastructure, provide education and training. So we have to find new funding models. We have to be adaptive. So the idea of doing 10-year strategic plans and then repeating them every 10 years, things change too much. So you got to do like planning in like 2-year cycles, 3-year cycles, and make them living documents. And then finally, you have to have ongoing assessment. People want to know, how do we know if we're on the right track? How do we know if we succeed? It's all about creating metrics, having measurement, and then transparency and communication, sharing those metrics. So in closing, a few lessons from the field. I start off with this one, don't bite off more than you can chew. And I want to be careful. I want people to have big visions and think big about new projects and opportunities. But when it comes to implementation, do a few things really well in your community, your neighborhood, your city, or your economic development organization. And realize you got to do things in small, digestible components, try them out, and then if they're working, do them more or scale them up. And if they're not working, adapt to a new model. Understand what you have impact over. Because, again, I mentioned this. At the local level, we have a lot of control over land use, permitting. We don't have so much control over workforce and global economies. So it's not that we don't care about those things, but we can't try to do everything ourselves. Give collaboration and engagement more than lip service, which is what you do here in the region, so I want to be clear. But a lot of times when I'm talking, there are regions that say, oh, I don't like that process. It takes too long and it's too expensive to involve citizens, to involve stakeholders, to have discussions, and they just kind of skip over it. Well, A, it's not going to lead to implementable projects and it's going to create problems down the road. You also, because things are changing so much and because they're becoming more technical, we don't have the answers. Collectively, we don't have the answers. So we can't say, I'm only going to do those things for which there is definitely going to be a positive result. If that was our criteria, we would just sit there in paralysis because we're not really sure what's going to work in this new environment. So that's why we have to continually monitor, assess, and adapt. And we have to, as leaders and communities, get comfortable with making decisions without complete information. And then finally, I'll just close on this, is whenever I work, we need to market ourselves. But usually when I say that, people think that they got to go externally and say, I got to market Syracuse so that the world knows how great we are. Well, that is absolutely true. But don't forget to market internally. And this is a form of marketing internally. Tell your stories. Share your information. People are going to carry that information out. And don't assume that they know it all the time and know the latest success stories. So focus both on communication and marketing internally as well as externally to the rest of the world. With that, I'll turn it over to Chris.
Nicely done. Jim, thank you very much for that. So I'm going to take about 15 minutes and tell you a little bit about my entire career and basically what I do for a living. So my name is Chris Steele, and I'm going to talk to you a little bit here about site selectors. So Jim was just talking about marketing the community, and I am, in fact, going to focus on that one part of economic development, which is somewhat externally facing, but it has internal implications as well. So first, I've just been using the term site selector here for a second, just to tell you who I am and why I'm here. I'm Chris Steele, not the one with the dossier, the other one. Although this is my dossier. What we do is we do corporate site location. This is what I've been doing for about a quarter century now, working with companies as big as Boeing with their headquarters relocation 20 years ago, through to as small as, I think the smallest project I worked on was a chicken processing plant in West Virginia. So it's like a pretty big gamut if you go from things that are big and metal and fly and small and poultry and don't. So it's been an interesting career. Through the span of that, we have learned a lot about how companies make location decisions, how those decisions start, the kinds of things that companies are looking for when they're trying to figure out where to set up that next plant or back office or headquarters, and the lessons that we can bring back to the public sector and communities pretty much around the globe to how to better prepare, how to better position themselves, how to better understand what they're going to be really strong for in the first place and the things they need to do to be able to succeed. So first, let's talk about what a site selector is. Now, I'm a land use planner by original training, and that's actually where I started off doing this stuff. We were looking at population trends, and then suddenly one day Merrill Lynch came in the door and said, hey, listen, you guys understand how this data works and how places change over time. Can you help us figure out where to put our next back office? And that's how I entered into this. So we're much more on the management consulting side and helping companies figure out what is it they're trying to achieve and where are the places that can do that. But there are other people that are likely to come into your community in the middle of a site selection process. So if you can start to think about it, it's everything from your traditional site selectors and management consultants, of which I fall into that category, real estate brokers and consultants, since at the end of the day, a real estate decision enables that site selection process to go forward. Attorneys, corporate management could be involved. A lot of corporate management is now doing the process on their own because of the availability of data online. That's really changed what we do on a day-to-day basis a lot. Tax consultants, these are the ones that you're typically seeing coming in when you're starting to talk about incentives and tax treatments and grants and things of that nature. Engineers, particularly on heavy manufacturing projects where you might need to figure out, soils, access, water, and be able to hold up a large structure. So there could be a pretty broad range of people that are involved in a site selection process. But the process itself usually takes place looking something like this. And it's important to see how this has changed. I'll explain that in a second. But how the process starts is, of course, you've got to start out by working with your client and figuring out what problem they're trying to solve. Before I was a planner, I had a master's in psychology, and so much of my everyday basis is group therapy. What's your problem? How long have you been feeling this way? What are your goals? How would you like to feel tomorrow? And then working with that to be able to understand what are the must-haves that a new location has to have to be able to get things going. What tools does that organization have to be able to implement their new location decision? How could their business change over time? And all of that goes into the constellation of what that new location needs to be able to do. Some things are going to have to be, they're binary, either you have it or you don't. So that's going to, once you take a look at that and take a look at your global locations, that starts to give you a long list of locations that you can look at. After that, there are things that are a little bit more of a trade-off. Am I willing to trade off cost for better access to certain markets? Am I looking at certain kinds of utilities versus a certain kind of tax treatment? Am I looking at a government that understands where I am now? Am I looking for other partners that can help me do what I'm looking to do? And some of those might end up going into a little bit of more of a waiting and ranking situation. And you might do one or more iterations of that. And then you've come to the point where you have run out of the data that is readily available to you on your desktop. So you actually have to go out and see what it looks like on the ground and whether that data actually has more behind it than you realized. And that's when we get out into the field and we're, the economic developers on the ground will get a call from a site selector that sounds a little bit like this. Hi, Hi, I'm Chris Steele. I'm calling from Investment Consulting Associates. Hey, listen, good to talk to you too. We'll talk families in a second. So here's the thing. We've got a project that's sitting here. You've made the shortlist. Congratulations. You're one of five locations that our project is considering, and we're about to go into the field. We'll be there in 2 days. We need you to find us five possible sites and also line up seven interviews with the following possible things. We'll be on the ground in 48 hours. See ya. Thanks. And then we're also doing cost modeling and final negotiations and location selection. I joke a little bit about that process timeline, but that in many cases is really how our lives as site selectors have changed and how the lives of economic developers in terms of the calls that they get and the nature of them has changed. I was mentioning about the data that we have on our desktops. It used to be, you know, back 10, 15 years ago, we would have to send an intern down to the county library to be able to pour through county business patterns data and maybe even census data and things of that nature. Now all of that is at our fingertips. Plus we have a lot more boutique firms that are providing us with data. So instead of sending a request for information out to a longer list of communities here, we have that data in-house, and it really does come down to that point where we're at the last 3 to 5 locations that we're looking at before we have to engage the communities. Now, this has profound implications for that marketing side of things that Jim was talking about. On the one hand, it means that when you get that RFI at the end of the day here, it's likely to be a lot slimmer, and it's only going to focus on the things that we haven't been able to find data about yet, which in most cases is a little bit of utilities information, but mostly about real estate. And very often it's the beginning of a negotiation with regards to, by the way, we've got like 500 people that we need to have trained. Do you have a training program that you can put in place? Or we need a road built. Can you help us find a tax credit or a grant to be able to have that happen? In my hypothesis, it's actually affected the debate a lot about how important real estate and incentives are to the site location process. They are no more important than they were in the past, but we've been able to answer a lot more of the questions up front before we have to make the request to the economic development agencies. The other implication for the economic developers that are doing that external marketing is that you don't have very much insight into the kinds of projects that you are being rejected for, or the kinds of projects that you are stronger or weaker for. So it means that you have an additional task, if you'd like to do it, to be able to try and look through this looking glass the other way, to be able to do your own weighting and ranking models to see, okay, let's say that I'm in competition for a biopharma manufacturing site, or an ag or a food production facility, or a data center. How do I look against my competitive peers so I can better understand what I'm good at and where I can start to make the relationships for either those companies, the ones that I have here now, so I make sure that they stay here and that they expand, or the ones that I'm trying to attract so I can start to actually build that case even before there's a project. It's important to note also that it's no one factor, it's no one particular data point that actually drives a site selection decision. It's that constant constellation and how those things interact with each other. So, you know, the more that you can kind of look at it, our job really has become, instead of what Jim was talking about before, you know, that kind of data house, we really have become a lot more of that problem solver and that trusted party that's sitting there from the outside of trying to game things out with that particular client to help them figure out how all of this stuff is going to fit together with the problem they presented to us in the first place, as well as a range of possibilities. You know, we get to be the what if people, to be able to see how all of this works out so that they can game out, okay, so if we go to Syracuse or if we go someplace else, what does that look like if thus or so happens to your particular business? So what does this mean for particularly the part of the economic development community that is trying to figure out how to attract and retain these kinds of investments? Well, the first part, and I've loved using this metaphor for a while, but the concept of, I'm sure that anybody who has kids or grandkids that has walked across a floor that looks like that knows what that is and has the scars on the bottom of their feet for it. But the analogy of the Lego model, the concept of you've bought the model, you've been able to build the thing that's on the front of the box, and the next question is what is the thing that you can build in addition to that based on what happens? From an economic development and a business attraction perspective, this is the concept of, we know that we have been a strong community for this. This has been our history. This has been our legacy. That means that we have this kind of workforce. We have this kind of infrastructure. We have this kind of real estate inventory. We have this kinds of transportation infrastructure. What else can we do with that? What parts are we possibly missing that we might want to put policies in place to develop over time? There are some pitfalls along the way as well, as you're starting to think about what else you might want to try and attract. The concepts of the, you know, are my relationships solid between the government and the economic development side and the private sector? Wishful thinking. I go to conferences and I say, what are you guys focusing on? And somebody will say, green tech. That's fabulous and God bless. What about green tech and why do you think that you have something to do with that? The more that you can better understand and be specific and talk about the different specific things that your community has done and is doing to be meaningfully involved in those sectors, the better off you are. Unresponsiveness, the concept of, you know, we've had situations where we have the site selection process going on. The call comes in and says, listen, I've got 48 hours to turn this around. Yeah, that's bad for us. Can you come back in like 3 weeks? Yeah, but it's going to be to tell you where that project went. Shortages of resources, everybody is resource constrained. Everybody is resource constrained. The question is, how creatively can you, be able to respond to, so I understand you're asking for this, but what really are you trying to get to? Because let me kind of streamline this so that we can actually get to the place where, you know, I can handle your response and we can go from there. Regulatory and institutional unreadiness. There are communities where you go and you say, what is your regulatory process and permitting process? And they say, this is our ombudsman, and they're going to walk you through the entire process. And we have regulations. We want you to adhere to them, but we'll walk you through it. And there are others that are basically, this is the phone book, and we think everybody's in it. The more you can be over here, the better. And then, of course, lack of community consensus. Jim was talking about this a lot at the beginning. The entire concept of who do we want to be as a community, what are the concerns, and have we been transparent, honest, and really discussed them at that front end? Now, from that, once you have some of those addressed, and once you want to try and unbox those Legos and figure out what else you want to be as a community and the kinds of things you can attract, you can start to do things along this line. I'm not going to go into every bucket here, but first, that investment strategy assessment. What are we good at? What are the things that we have in terms of workforce, in terms of educational institutions, in terms of infrastructure? Who are the stakeholders that control that and really are able to speak for that? How do we get them to the table? Market analysis. What's going on in that global overall marketplace? What's going to be hot now? What's going to be hot in the immediate future to the extent that we can possibly foretell? And where do we match up with that? The industry targeting. Once we have figured out where our matches are, the things that are likely to be active, both in terms of helping our companies here as well as trying to attract from abroad, how do we make our case to them? And then from that, we can start to then figure out both on a regulatory and a programmatic side, what are the things we need to do to be more competitive, to be more responsive, and then how do we get out there and start to make that message known? Now, with that, I think we are ready to kind of open things up. I held just under my 15 minutes. I was very proud of
that. That's good, because I went over.
Chris.
Thanks very much. I look forward to talking to you.
Thank you, Chris. So I think one of the objectives that we had for this series of forums was to give people an idea of what really goes on in terms of economic development, because I think too often what we get is a story that comes out in some kind of media that's very simplistic about maybe the end of a project, and there's an explanation of what went on, and then people focus in on one or two things when they don't really understand all of this is going on behind the scenes. All of these are the challenges that the people that we have in our community who are doing economic development on our behalf are facing, and how technical it is, how much data there is that they're trying to go through, and how when a site selector shows up, they have 48 hours. It's not they're going to come in and they're going to give you 2 weeks to get your act together. You got 48 hours, and they have to scramble and they have to pull the right people together. So with that, I want to give everybody a chance. This is a great group that likes this type of information. What questions do you have for Chris or Jim?
I have a question for Jim.
Uh-oh.
Jim, you mentioned network, people, networking, and workforce. We have in Central New York a very large refugee community. And many of those people are skilled in certain areas. and they're very, then also they can be educated. They're looking for jobs. How would you suggest approaching a refugee community in Central New York to make them available for job creation?
Yeah, really good question, and it's a common problem or a common issue, if you will. So I mentioned that I'm from Maine. It's smaller, but the issue there is we also have a strong refugee population, particularly around like the Somali community, which is, if you know anything about Maine, it's not at all like Somalia. So the reason I bring that up is part of the way I'm going to answer the question is, one, I'll talk about a couple of programs, but two, it's really about having cultural understanding and acceptance. That's the first issue. In other words, I think we have to dispel the myths that there's people from away and people from here, and that there are opportunities out there that both we as companies and communities need good quality labor force, and all people that are within our boundaries need an opportunity to succeed, to have a purposeful, meaningful job and employment, because that's what's going to make great communities. So one way to do it, more recently, I'll just give an example, is Bangor, Maine has, I forget the exact name, but it's like the Center for Immigration and Diversity, I think it's called. But they have a lot of discussions and forums where they're talking about job opportunities, what companies need, how to start a business. But they're all based also on understanding different cultures and what the needs of refugees and immigrants are in the area. So all I would say is there's different programs out there where people are doing it, but it all starts with an understanding and an acceptance. If it's going to be us versus them, or seen as just a problem to fix, it's not going to be addressed. If you understand that we're all in this together and there's an opportunity. And I'll just end on one other note on that. Think about this. We've been in economies where we've had 10% unemployment, 12% or higher unemployment. Now they're saying the official unemployment is like around 4%. In all those cases, every single time, getting skilled workers is still a problem. So in other words, it's not the unemployment rate that's creating this problem. It's the ability to integrate people into the workforce, into meaningful jobs, and having the right skills to support the companies. So that's a great opportunity. And another community that's sort of leveraged that is Allentown, PA. We think of Allentown as being the old manufacturing in terms of Mack truck and things like that. And they've had tough times historically, but they've also been able to grow their workforce through working with diversity, refugees, and immigrants, and providing new urban manufacturing opportunities. So you can grow the economy with a really good program that helps refugees get employment.
Good morning. Thank you for your presentations. Mm-hmm. I may be overgeneralizing, but it seems to me here in Central New York, we have one strategy for enticing companies, and that is to offer them lavish tax benefits. And at the same time, our poverty rate is enormous, and we're losing potential income. So I'm hoping there are more strategies available.
So let me actually talk to you from the standpoint of how things look, first of all, from the site selector's eyes. Process does not start with the incentives, and the incentives can that comes later. It has to be a good location for business to begin with before you even start to talk about any sort of incentive. I will caution you with regards to, you know, I put that slide up there with who's a site selector, and you do need to kind of pay attention a little bit as to who's asking the question when the site selection projects comes to town. But for those of us that are looking on the site selection, the management consulting side, we are concerned, first and foremost, is this a place where this business can succeed and thrive and work with a government that understands it well, that has a good workforce, that has good infrastructure, that doesn't have any sort of structural problems, and that can support it over time. The incentive is, you know, if it's anything, it's frosting on the cake later. Just the advice that we commonly give when governments ask us about the incentive question, it is the first and foremost, make sure that you have your workforce working and your infrastructure good. To the extent that we talk about incentives afterwards, we're going to be looking for something that is net beneficial to both sides. In other words, if for whatever reason this project happens to fail, the community still has to be better off for the awarding of the incentive, meaning like a training grant or putting infrastructure in place that can be used to entice the next thing down. So I know I'm not answering your question directly, but it's more I am answering it from kind of where we sit on the site selection side.
Good morning. I'm in the commercial real estate development and brokerage business.
Yep.
This is right in my wheelhouse. Thank you both for being here. Question, Chris. When you have a new engagement, what type of industries make you think Syracuse should be on my list?
Honestly, it's interesting. I was just talking about this last night at the Citizens Academy. One thing I did not think that we were going to be seeing a lot of, you know, again in my career was manufacturing. I've looked at Syracuse for a couple of different projects, more than a couple of different projects over my career, everything from back office and shared service centers and whatnot. One of the things that I keep thinking about upstate New York as a whole about more recently is manufacturing, and it's because there is still that talent base that is here that is not necessarily other places in the United States. The caution that I gave last night is that it is a technical workforce that exists now, and we as a nation have not necessarily done as much as we could to make sure that it is refreshed over time. But if I'm looking for skilled machinists, CAD operators, people that really know how to take a concept to a physical object, this is one of the markets I'm absolutely looking at.
Quickly, I didn't hear you talk about livability as a factor, Chris, especially if a company's bringing people. Quality of education, quality of health care, poverty, crime, where does that fit at all?
It fits actually very considerably, especially if you're talking about any sort of a... We used to make a joke about this years ago where economic developers would come up to us when they didn't have anything else to say, we've got great quality of life, and we say, yes, we understand you live there and that you like it. However, in a very tangible way, that conversation has become very real and very important. With all of the different functions we're looking at now, where no one labor market can supply everybody right. That we're looking for, and recruitability becomes a much more important factor. So the concepts of livability, quality of life, have become very important, specifically if you can understand how those apply to a particular kind of labor force you're looking for. So if you can kind of, you know, again, go through that looking glass in reverse a little bit and try and understand the kinds of functions and industries that you would be very good for, think about what's going to appeal to the workers, the researchers, the innovators, the executives for those kinds of industries, and try to do what you can to create a livability situation that would appeal to them.
This is mostly for Jim. What tools are in your toolbox to make sure that the people who have not been able to participate in wealth creation in the past, the people who are really living in some of the concentrated poverty that we have here, can participate in the economic development as wealth gets created later? I think we have a lot of people who are wary of economic development because they feel like they're just going to be pushed out.
Yeah, I think that starts with an understanding that economic development isn't just about real estate development and company creation. Right. In other words, and that's very important to economic development, but when you go back to the holistic system idea of it, it starts with both the programs are both around, we were talking about refugees earlier, but it could be you understanding that taking, you know, engaging the entire workforce is both good for people in the neighborhood, workers, and for the businesses themselves. So there's a lot of workforce side programs where that matters. Secondly, and this is just starting to happen, believe it or not, again, like poverty and income were considered social programs or social problems, and they are. I'm not saying they're not, but they were put over here by economic developers. But there's becoming more and more of a recognition around how these have to be addressed to have meaningful economic development. I'm involved in the International Economic Development Council, and I sit on their Research Partners Program, and we sponsor research each year and conduct research around critical emerging issues, and that's one of the biggest issues right now is the idea of wealth, integration, inclusion, those kinds of issues. I will say, so therefore the next step is if your economic development entities need to, somebody in that system in economic development needs to have that on their plate. Not that they're going to be the ones that solve the problem, but it's going to be integrated into their strategy. And yesterday we were able to meet with Andrew Fish from, is Andrew here today?
No.
Or
yeah.
From Center State. And it was really good to hear they're already doing that. In other words, they don't just look at economic development as a chamber function of serving businesses or just attracting companies. They actually have inclusion and wealth and prosperity as a key piece to what they do.
From my perspective, one of the biggest nuts in this whole area is who pays for the work for the workforce training and retraining.
I'll start, but I know you have ideas, because we have a little bit, not a different perspective, but there's two sides of this too. So there's any issue in economics is always about supply and demand and who therefore pays. So I do believe that it has to be shared, and I like ideas around, I don't want companies to just be able to say, hey, you, the community or the region, you provide us the skilled workers. We need this many workers, and we want them by such and such a date. In other words, you as the company also need to make the investment. And I think Chris will give some examples of where that occurs. But also, so it has to happen on the company side. They've got to be working with the education institutions, and it has to be supported by a solid public education base. And that gets back to inclusion as well, whereas if it's, I get concerned when we go only into a skills-based system based on merit, where only those who can afford to and take the time to get the latest, best training, they're going to succeed, and then everybody else is still going to be left behind. So who pays for it is a complex combination of the federal government, the state government, the local governments, but also partnering with industry and nonprofits and the education system.
So what Jim is referring to in terms of the additional perspective on top of that, we've started to work with companies that it had been for a long time that companies would be out there saying, boy, you know, we need these skills. We can't find them anywhere. We need a company. We need a government that actually can put them together. Some of the companies we've been working with have taken a different perspective, which is let's work with the local governments to be able to find people with a basic level of skills. But then that talent base that we're looking to do is somewhere between unusual and unique, and it's a strategic strength to us as a company. So if you can find local municipality folks with basic skills and make sure that they've been appropriately trained and educated through the public schools and things like that, we're going to take them internally. We're going to train them in our ways and our ways of doing things, and that's a competitive advantage for us, and we want to own that. Now, it's not universal, but we've seen enough examples of it that it's something that we're paying attention to.
Well, thank you, Chris and Jim. Let me give a hand to Jim and Chris for coming in town.
Oh, thank you.